gentlemen, welcome back to the Being Husband Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan West, bringing you guys another episode here. Telling you all, like I always do, gents, thank you for being a part of the work that we're doing. Guys, if you've been with us for any length of time, then you know what we're all about here. We're here to help you as a man live on mission in your marriage. And today is no different than that. No, gents, we're going to be having a conversation with the one and only Dr. Sean Baker. Dr. Sean Baker is the founder of MeatRx and is a huge, huge name and influence in the carnivore diet space. So I'm excited to have this conversation because I want to know what this is all about. And I want to know if it's good, if it's bad, and how I can best get into it. So I hope you guys are looking forward to that episode or looking forward to this episode. The audio quality is a little rough because I got into a situation where I was out of town and was in traffic and ended up having to do the interview on my phone. And so had to be flexible, had to get it done, but I wanted to make sure that you guys got this conversation because Dr. Sean Baker's a busy guy and he's hard to get a hold of. So I wanted to make sure that we were able to get the conversation squared away and get this out to you guys. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Dr. Sean Baker of MeatRx. Hey, Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Gotcha. And I need to know, because you're kind of making a name for yourself. Do I call you Sean or Dr. Baker, Dr. Carnival?
You know, you call me whatever you want. I mean, I've been called so many things. A lot of them not very nice. So I don't really mind anything. So whatever makes you. Sean's fine. That's fine. That's great.
I got you. I appreciate you coming on and taking time with us. I wanted to kind of jump in, too, with a lot of what you've got going on. But before I get to that, how did you end up where you're at? How did you end up Dr. Sean Baker, the meat doctor? How did you step into this lane? Like, walk me through maybe not necessarily grade school, but walk me through maybe early adulthood into where you're at now. How'd you get where you're at?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, the doctor part was something I always wanted to be a doctor. You know, I can remember being back, I think as early as sixth grade, you know, I liked science and I figured out by the time I was 16, I was going to go into medical school and started studying for the MCAT as a 16-year-old. I remember I was at a job. I used to work. I was a big kid. I worked I worked at a hotel. I started at 14. I was cleaning dishes and I was a busboy. Then I was a room service waiter. And the pinnacle of my success, I think at age 16 or 17, I got to be the doorman at a nightclub at this Hilton hotel. Because I was a big kid and they thought, well, I'd know all the kids who were underage and I'd kick them out or something like that. But I mean, I would sit there and I'd study for the medical college acceptance test, you know, and I wasn't supposed to take it. I was a junior in college. So I started studying about 5 years early. So, and you know, then I was always into athletics and sports and basketball and, you know, different sports through the years. And so I got to medical school, went to medical school. And then, you know, cause funny, I got about a year into medical school and I started playing rugby and really got pretty good at it. I was a decent natural athlete. And, I got good enough where I got recruited to go play like semi-professionally overseas. And I said, well, I'm going to quit medical school, which is kind of crazy at the time. But I was like, well, what the heck? It's the only chance I'm going to get to do it. So I went over there, played rugby. I did it for about 7 years. Joined the military, the U.S. Air Force, and I was a nuclear weapons guy. So I launched nuclear bombs for my day job and played rugby for the Armed Forces team and did that for a while. And then I was about, I think I was 30 years old. I remember I was laying at the bottom of this pile and there was this Russian guy kicking me in the head and I had blood coming to my ears. And I said, man, I'm done with this stuff. You know, it's just like, I'm getting old and, it's time to hang the boots up. So I went back to medical school. The Air Force was kind enough to pay for it. Did my training, graduated with honors from medical school, did my surgical training in Galveston, Texas, University of Texas Medical Branch. And then went into Air Force, you know, practice. And then I was sent to Afghanistan, did a bunch of, you know, pretty crazy combat surgery for quite a while overseas, came back, finished up my commitment, went into private practice. And, you know, the whole time I was competing in sports and I was able to successfully break some national records in weight and powerlifting, specifically in the deadlift. As a drug-free athlete, I was deadlifting. I think my best deadlift was 772 pounds. Then I got into different stuff. I got into like track and field. I did a little bit of that for a while where I threw the discus and the super heavyweight and I got all American masters in that. Then I went into Highland Games, won a world championship in that as a masters athlete, got into competitive rowing, set some world records, won a world championship in that. And, you know, now I'm kind of switched over. I'm doing jiu-jitsu now. So that's my sports background. Wow. But about when I was about 40, I'd say I was about 42, 43 years of age. I mean, I was still training. I was training hard. I mean, I was working as a surgeon. I was busy, but I always found time to train. If I had to train at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd do it. You know, I would always train. I had a gym in my house, always made time to train, always trained hard, but my health was getting worse. I mean, I was probably pre-diabetic, high blood pressure, sleep apnea. I was 280 something pounds. I was a big athlete. I had to be for Highland Games. I mean, 6'5", 280 was kind of like the minimum requirement. And a lot of the guys were 6'7", 350. So, I mean, they're big, big people, right? This is like going with these giants. And then, then I said, hey, I don't want to do that anymore. So I started looking at different diets. And I started out with this low-fat, lots of vegetables, lean protein diet, and lost about 50 pounds, got from 280 to 230 in about 3 months. And I was, like, just miserable. I mean, I was like, the nurses at the hospital, I was working at a surgeon at the time, and the nurse was like, man, you are not a pleasant person to be around. Because, I mean, I was hungry. I was grouchy. I was always thinking about food. I was just, wasn't something I could sustain. I mean, I'm a pretty disciplined person. And then I switched over. I started doing this more of a paleo diet. And then I started doing a low-carb diet. And then I started eventually, and, you know, this is about a period of about 3 or 4 years. And I ended up doing a ketogenic diet. And that was kind of like the switch. It was kind of a different metabolic switch for me. I kind of like, wow, this is a different way to deal with hunger. Cravings aren't there. I'm able to eat, not be hungry. I could go all day without eating, which was unusual for me. Because usually I was eating 4, 5, 6 times a day, eating 7, 8,000 calories pretty easily, big guy. I mean, I got to dinner. I'd order 3 entrees. I mean, it was not unusual for me to do that. You know, this is back in the day, right? I got into that and I was like, well, it's really changed for my appetite. And then so we had, you know, as a surgeon, I was taking care of a lot of people that, you know, had worn out knees and worn out hips, and a lot of them were overweight and significantly overweight. And it was kind of risky to bring those people to the operating room because they would be at higher risk for infections. They would have problems with the anesthetic, you know, they would have high risk for blood clots. And so you really try to encourage people to lose weight before doing these big operations on them. Mm-hmm. However, most of the time they were never successful. You'd say, hey, you know, Mrs. Jones, we need you to drop 50 pounds before we can replace your knee. And, you know, you check back with them a month later and they'd lost maybe 3 pounds, and you check back with them in 2 months and then they gained 10 pounds and they're in there crying. And there's my knee hurts so much. And you just kind of say, okay, we're just going to do it. And, you know, hopefully you don't have complications. But when I started putting people on a, you know, kind of a low carbohydrate diet, I saw 2 things happen. One, I had a high percent of people that were actually successful, but people were losing weight pretty rapidly. Not everybody, but many of them were. But more sort of intriguing to me was the fact that I put these people on a new diet and the knee pain that they're getting ready for surgery would go away. They're like, well, my knee doesn't hurt anymore. And sometimes they hadn't lost much weight yet. They lost maybe 5 pounds and they're like, my knee stopped hurting. To me, that was kind of an aha moment. I said, this is interesting. So I got really excited about that and sort of really delving into nutrition. And, I decided that, like, look, I really want to focus on this. I've been operating as a surgeon for, you know, a long time. And I was, you know, I've done so many operations, thousands of operations. I was like, you know, it's just like another day at the office. Just, you know, even as a surgeon, it's the same thing over and over again. You want it to be boring. You really want surgery to be boring. You don't want excitement in the operating room. You want everything to be smooth and boring. And that's kind of, and that's fine. And that's great. But at the same time, I was like, I was really excited. I was like, wow, these people are getting better and I don't have to do surgery on them. This is really, to me, I thought it was really cool. But that's not the way hospitals operate. They prefer that, you know, you, you do the procedure because there's a lot of revenue that's generated. You know, it's the hospital stay, the anesthesia stay, the rehab, the imaging, you know, the outpatient stuff. There's millions of dollars that goes into that stuff. So when I started cutting into that, the hospital didn't really like that much. And so we parted ways, you know, and I ended up focusing on lifestyle. And so, you know, a couple of years went by and I formed this company, which I now do. And so that is kind of the evolution of where I am as I am now, you know, as this crazy meat guy. Now, I had no intention, you know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, you're going to be the meat doctor that, you know, talk about this. I would have thought that's nuts and crazy. And I still sometimes say it gets a little nutty, but, you know, it is what it is. You know, I just started doing this and I was just barely on social media. I had a few people, maybe a couple thousand people following me on Twitter. You know, I've been on there a year or so. And I was like, hey, I'm going to do this all meat diet for a month. And we kind of laughed. I thought it was kind of a joke too. I said, I'll just do it as a joke. You know, I was kind of halfway. I kind of experimented with it a little bit, you know, for a week here, a week there. And I felt pretty good. So let's do it for a month. And so I publicized it, and I was kidding. And I said, hey, you know, what do you think I'm going to die of? Because surely I'm going to die. If I do meat for 30 days, I'm going to drop dead. I'm either going to have a heart attack, I'm going to get scurvy, my colon's going to fall out from no fiber. And, you know, I put a little poll. I remember put a poll up, and I can't remember what the number one answer was, but it was something like heart's going to clog up. And none of that happened. And in fact, I was like, wow, I feel tremendous. I feel the best I've felt in really years. And so when the 30 days was over, I went back to, you know, the regular diet, and I mean, immediately felt worse. And I was like, well, this is odd. You know, I don't want to feel bad. So I went, so I rolled right back into doing meat, and I've kind of been there now for about 5 years. And so since that time, you know, Joe Rogan noticed, got me on the podcast, that got a lot of attention, a lot of people, it attracted a lot of people, particularly like a lot of vegan activists that don't like the fact that I tell people meat is healthy. I ate a lot of meat. So they started attacking me. And so, you know, and I started pushing back. I was like, well, you know, screw you guys. I'm gonna point out your silliness and nonsense. So I've been doing some of that stuff. But in the meantime, you know, I mean, there are now tens of thousands of people who have done this, and we have seen just so many life-changing, dramatic successes of things I never thought I would see improve. Mm-hmm. Like rheumatoid arthritis and it goes away, or psoriasis and it goes away, or even things like PTSD and depression, and all those things get remarkably better when you do nutrition. And it makes sense. You know, you think about nutrition has a huge role in our health, much bigger than we give it credit for. And I think there's probably very few diseases in which nutrition doesn't at least have an impact, if not might even be the cause. And so we're seeing that. And so we've just kind of continued to grow over the last couple of years. You know, as we started this company, MeatRx, we've gotten just more and more successes, and we're just excited. And so we're really excited where the future goes. And, you know, as you point out, there is a big push to make everybody eat less meat and to sort of do that. And I think that's clearly the wrong direction. I think there's things, your compromise that can be made, and things on how we produce it that'll help. You know, I think there's a win-win solution. You know, right now this is throwing the baby out with the bathwater solution, which is going to end up really come back to bite people. I mean, we already start to see that to some degree. I mean, if you look at the U.S. population, and this is kind of, you can almost extrapolate this to the whole world. I mean, we have, in no time ever have we had more people that are suffering from depression, chronic pain, obesity, diabetes, you know, cancer, heart disease, all those things are just going on and on and on. Everybody's sick. I mean, you can't really go outside and not see sick people. I mean, it's impossible. It's like you go to any main gathering where there's a lot of people, you're going to find somebody who's overweight, you're going to find somebody who's probably diabetic, you're going to find somebody who's got chronic pain, you're going to find somebody who's depressed. I mean, you can't throw a baseball and not hit a sick person. I mean, that is a sad reality, you know, and it shouldn't be that way. And so I think largely much of it has to do with our new diet that's been kind of put on us in the last, you know, 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Well, so say a little bit more about that. So when you say new diet, you mean like the standard way that most of us eat, which is heavy carbohydrate, low protein, no fat. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing is, you know, just the highly ultra processing of the food. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, think about if you were in nature, in the wild, and you're eating, I mean, just the fact that we now have powders that we eat, you know, whether it's flour, whether it's sugar, whether it's protein powder. I mean, how can your teeth make powder? I mean, you can't take anything and turn it into powder with your teeth unless you chew it for like 6 days. I mean, but if you're, you know, even if you're, you know, banana, you don't turn it into powder. You don't turn a steak into powder. You don't turn nuts into powder. But now we have all these flours and powders and stuff like that. And so what happens is it makes that energy available at a very high amount, very quickly, very small surface area. And so our body's not designed to absorb food that way. I mean, there's a very specific way in which we're designed physiologically to eat. And there's certain hormones and certain enzymes that are supposed to be secreted and stimulated in a temporal slow time sequence. That's being bypassed and hacked. And so when you eat flour and sugar and, you know, concentrated fat, you know, all in one go, I mean, that's not how we're designed to eat. And, you know, we see the more we do that, one, it's, you know, the food has become so, I mean, they've gotten very good at making it palatable. You know, I mean, they can make industrial waste products taste delicious, right? I mean, that's that's where the cereal industry came out. And cereal, prior to the early late 1800s, was I mean, it was waste. It was like the farmers, like, we're just waste, throwing this stuff away and it's garbage. You know, maybe we want to feed it to some animals. But then they figured out, hey, if we add some vitamins to it and fortify it, maybe sprinkle a little sugar on it, we can feed it to these people. And guess what? It's super cheap. We can make a lot of profit on that. And this is the creation of the cereal industry. And then we just see that on and on and on with all these other foods. I mean, there's, you know, I think there's sawdust is in something like 10% of our foods. I mean, it's called methyl cellulose. So they're feeding us sawdust. The USDA is just now, I think within about a year ago, has authorized cotton, you know, cotton that you make your shirt out of, you know, from a cotton field, for humans to eat. You know, they figured out how to process this, and now we can eat it. So we're going to be eating cotton in our food next. And it just goes on and on. We're not designed to eat that stuff. And it's making us sick for sure.
Yeah, that is crazy. So for guys that are listening to this, a lot of us are kind of in this space where we're like, all right, we want to know how to eat well. Mm-hmm. And then there's two things. Guys are really concerned with being strong physically. Yeah. Yeah. And they're really concerned about their testosterone levels. So give us the case for me on male health in general. Like, is it supreme to male health? It's like, intuitively, it seems like it would be that's really important to male health in terms of testosterone, sperm production, things like that. Is that accurate?
Right. So there's a lot of nuance in that question. So the short answer is yes. I mean, there's some very good advantages to a meat-based diet with regard to that stuff. Now, you know, if you go back to, you know, Harvey Kellogg, you know, William Harvey Kellogg, back in back to the cereal, they, you know, this is part of the Seventh Day Adventist stuff, who has impacted nutrition in a huge way. The American Dietetic Association, which was founded in 1917, was largely founded by the Seventh Day Adventist Church. They were strict vegetarian people. They strongly believed that meat was evil. They felt that meat, red meat in particular, was not very pure, and it led to lust, and it led to things like, you know, masturbation. It was sinful. And so what they do is they took red meat out of the diet and fed them grain. And that actually worked. But they're like, well, my libido went away and I don't, you know. So it does. It actually does. So red meat does actually. And what I see is people that go on a meat-based diet is they notice my libido gets better. You know, sexual function improves. But a lot of people will get stronger. Now, again, we mentioned this earlier. I think you need to do things to make yourself stronger: resistance training, exercise, run some sprints, lift some weights, that type of stuff. But when it comes to, sort of male function, you know, you look at what are the effects of testosterone. Well, we know that they're pro muscle. They tend to make people carry less fat. They have a positive mental cognitive benefits. The benefits to the sexual function are there, and so that is sort of, you know, what the function is. That's what you want it to do. You know, whatever your number is, testosterone number can be up or down. It doesn't matter as much, because there's total testosterone, and some of it's bound to something called sex hormone binding globulin. Some of it's free. And then there's receptors it has to interact with. So you have to have all those things working in the right ratios. And so if you have a lot of testosterone, but you have a very small number of receptors, it's effectively like having testosterone resistance. You know, we've heard of insulin resistance, you know, where the insulin receptor isn't working very well, or maybe it's not expressed as much. You can see the same thing with a testosterone receptor. So ultimately the answer is most people on a fully carnivore diet or heavy red meat diet will see improvements in all of the things we talked about clinically. And that's what I care about at the end of the day. I don't really care what someone's number is. I care about what their function is. Can they, you know, are they happy? Are they mental cognition? Are they getting what they want out of their body? So on and so forth. And so that's an important aspect of it. You know, one of the misconceptions around red meat is, you know, they think, well, it's going to clog your arteries and you're going to get, you know, problems with erections because of blood flow. That's not actually what's going on there. You know, what we see with red meat, you know, if we look at, you know, randomized controlled trials, because a lot of people are worried about, you know, red meat and fat and cholesterol. The randomized controlled trials, specifically to say red meat, there's none that show that red meat causes heart disease, that it causes arteries to be clogged, that it causes cancer, anything. There's no randomized controlled trials. What there are some epidemiological associational studies where they'll look at 50,000 people and say, how much red meat did you eat? And then they'll say, well, these people had a 20% higher risk of heart disease, and therefore red meat causes cancer. But that's not really science. That's not how it's done. That's not a real scientific experiment. That's just saying there's a relationship there. Is the relationship valid? Can we test it? And you could say, well, those people that are eating red meat also smoke more. They also drink more. They also don't exercise very much. They also tend to be more obese. They also don't engage in any other healthy behaviors. They tend to eat at McDonald's. You know, they tend to eat at McDonald's, and what do they eat with that meat? They eat, some French fries that are cooked in soybean oil or canola oil, and they chase it down with a Coca-Cola, and they have, you know, a Frosty afterwards or something like that. So that's a very different population than when you say somebody who cares about their health, they exercise, you know, they don't eat a bunch of garbage, and they still eat a lot of meat. That's kind of my demographic. I mean, I'm not trying to have a heart attack. Believe me, that's the last thing I want. I exercise, I work out, I lift weights, I strength train. I don't eat junk. I don't eat garbage. I don't smoke. You know, I don't do any of these things, you know, these bad behaviors, but I eat a lot of red meat. I eat, you know, 4 pounds of red meat a day. You know, that's a lot, right? I mean, and you know, like I said, I had my heart checked, zero calcification, zero blockage, at all in my heart. You know, my blood pressure is perfectly normal. I mean, I'm about turned 55, and I'm out here, you know, doing jiu-jitsu with 20-year-olds and crushing them. I mean, I'm literally, you know, in tremendous shape. You know, I've set world records in competitive rowing, and I had my times were faster than, you know, at a 500 meter distance than many Olympic gold medalists, you know, in that sport. Right. They competed in a distance. They're doing 2000 meters. We're doing 500, which is a sprint, but I'm beating those guys, and I'm in my 50s. So, I mean, but say I have heart disease or that type of stuff, it's kind of nonsense. And what we're seeing, in fact, we're seeing a lot of people actually start to reverse heart disease anecdotally on a diet that doesn't include a lot of extra sugar and refined carbohydrates and these industrial oil products, you know, these seed oils, the vegetable oils that are so common. I mean, we didn't invent those. I mean, the cotton gin, you know, when Eli Whitney and the cotton gin, remember from grade school, you sing the song Eli Whitney, you know, whatever it was, 1860, whatever. You know, they had all this cotton oil, seed oil. They use it as an industrial lubricant. That's what they used it for. And then somebody figured out how to hydrogenate or partially hydrogenate. I think it was a German guy. I can't remember the name of his name. And they figured, oh, we can feed it to people now. And then, so that's that is the origin of, you know, cottonseed oil. And then it became, you know, canola oil and soybean oil and all this other stuff that's subsequently followed. That stuff is not part of the human diet. I mean, I don't care how long ago you think humans arrived, but before 120 years ago, no one was eating cottonseed oil or Crisco or all this stuff. No one. I mean, you could argue there. You make an argument that people were eating olive oil. You know, that's a different technology. You know, you squeeze an olive, you can get some oil out of it, but you don't squeeze, you don't squeeze a cotton plant and get a bunch of, you know, oil out of it. You know, it's like almond milk. You know, you just don't you don't milk an almond. You
know? No, it doesn't have udders.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, so, Sean, let me ask you this, because a lot of guys will say to me, they'll say, all right, so this one doctor and, you know, maybe Jordan Peterson is advising for the carnivore diet.
Right.
And maybe Joe Rogan is. But isn't that conditional on certain types of people? Right. Isn't that something that one of my guys I told that I was having you on, he said, well, I read once that blood type plays a factor, right? That O positive people tend to be ones that can digest meat better, or ones that actually see a lot of the benefits that you're referring to. But somebody that's A or B is probably not going to see the same benefit. Would you say that across the board, a carnivore-based diet is good for everyone? I mean, again, baseline that you're active. But
sure. Well, but I mean, even if you're not active.
Even if you're not active.
Go ahead. Jump into that. You know, first of all, the blood type thing, you know, it's interesting, you know. And I've had that question asked to me year after year after year. And what I've done is I've just asked people that are doing this diet successfully what their blood type is. And I always consistently get, I'm A type, I'm B type, I'm AB, I get a wide variety. So there doesn't seem to be any predominance of people that can have success. I mean, I have people from all over the world. We have people in India and Africa, in South America, in Northern Europe, in the United States and Canada and Mexico, in Australia, you know, all over the world doing this diet with success. And again, the same thing with the blood types. Now, does everybody have success with this? Is everybody suited for it? No, I'd say not. I mean, I think there's some people that just, they just don't like it. They just don't like, I want to eat other things, and that's fine. There's people that, for whatever reason, hey, I can't afford to eat meat. Or there's countries, you know, what amazes me, you know, India, large parts of India, beef is basically illegal. They're actually killing people for eating beef. I mean, in parts of the world, I mean, that's crazy. I mean, there's been like 50 murders in India for people that were, you know, involved in eating meat. But wow. I have people in India that they eat goat and lamb and chicken and fish and eggs, and they do well with that. And so I think the baseline, at a very baseline, I think all human beings have a capacity to eat meat and thrive on meat. Now, I think some people have more capacity to tolerate additional foods. So, you know, like, you know, lactose intolerance, for instance, that's a really good example. About a third of the world is lactose tolerant, about two thirds of the world are lactose intolerant. And so you'd say, well, you know, these people can add dairy to their diet. Some people do better with certain types of wheat. I mean, there's, you know, if we look at, you know, the beginnings of agriculture, it arguably began in the Fertile Crescent, which is in the Middle East, where all the grains were first evolved, you know, because of the climate there about, you know, 12,000 years ago. So those people got more exposure to it. And so that spread. And then so we see, you know, certain people have more capacity to tolerate other things. You know, I think certain people, they sort of evolved in more of a tropical environment, Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, parts of South America, where tropical foods, tropical fruits and things like that were accessible. They probably have more capacity to handle those types of food. But meat has been ubiquitous everywhere. You know, if you look at species in the world, you know, looking at the most diverse species, about where the different ecological niches that species can inhabit, humans are the most diverse species in the world. I mean, you don't find whales, you know, in certain parts of the world. You don't find tigers in all parts of the world. You don't find rhinos in all parts of the world. You don't find parakeets in all parts of the world. But you find human beings in every single place in the world, for the most part. The second most diverse animal is a wolf. Wolves are just the second, and we have very similar diets. And there's a reason for that, because we can survive in all these different regions, not because a magic super berry grows in every part of the world.
There's
always meat there. And so wow. Humans have always been able to live in different areas because they've had access to meat. So I think meat is something that all people inherently have. Now, there's people that, you know, over time, as they get sicker, as their digestive system starts to kind of fall apart with age or disease, then they have a harder time with that. But I think, you know, right out of the womb, starting with baby can eat meat. You know, I think that's fine. I think as long as people stay healthy, they can continue to eat meat and can eat a lot of it, quite honestly. Now, does everybody need to be on a carnivore diet? No. I look at it like this. I look at it as a problem fixer. You know, if you come in and you got depression or arthritis or autoimmune disease or gastrointestinal problem, too much weight, this works very well. It's a really good elimination diet. Many people feel so good on it, myself included, they just stick with it. It's like, this is the best I've ever felt. You know, I don't really want to trade eating my favorite pizza for feeling like garbage. I mean, it's not worth it to me. At some point, there's a trade-off where it's like, you know, and some people never make that trade-off. Some people are the only pleasure they have in life is what they put in their mouth. I mean, their life is so sort of otherwise devoid of joy and passion and excitement that the only thing they get a thrill from are sitting down watching a movie, you know, on Netflix and eating ice cream and a pizza.
Yeah,
that's a sad existence, quite honestly. But I think there's really no physiologic reason that I know of. I mean, there's a few rare protein metabolism diseases where you can't eat much protein. That's such a rare thing. That's like a one in a million type of situation. But for most people, I think that a carnivore diet is something they can do. You know, do they need to stick to it? Would they want to stick to it? Do they want to even try it? I mean, that's going to vary for people. I mean, if somebody's healthy and doing great and where they're at, keep, you know, more power to you. Keep going. I've never been, you know, this isn't, I don't do this, you know, I, you know, because a lot of people like say, well, there's vegans on this side and carnivores on that side. But I mean, veganism is an ideology. If you talk to any vegan, so it's not a diet, it's a belief system. A carnivore diet has got one goal, get you healthy. I don't care, you know, I'm not here to save the tomatoes or the cucumbers or to, you know, save the world. I'm here to say, how do I get people healthy? Make them feel good so they're not sick. And, you know, and oh, by the way, this is interesting. Most people don't know that. The United States healthcare system puts out 10% of our greenhouse gases. That's five times as much as the cattle in the United States. Cattle put out 2%. Healthcare puts out 10%. So if you get healthy by not eating garbage and just eating meat, you're no longer contributing to the healthcare system by using pills and going to the doctor all the time and having procedures. You're actually becoming more environmentally sustainable. And so I think this is a way to, because there's that argument about, we need to save the planet. I've got this shirt, eat meat, save the planet.
Save the planet.
there's a reason for that. I mean, there's some truth to that. So, but anyway, that's how I got here.
Yeah. What are some good ways then? You've kind of made the case. You pointed out the health benefits. So they're trying to reduce meat consumption. Everywhere is trying to reduce meat consumption, and there's a lot of big push for vegan. There's a big push for plant-based meats, whatever. What are good ways for us to consume meat? If you're talking to a guy that's like, hey, I live in a place where there's not that many options. Would you say, is it just as simple as going down to your local farmer and getting in a relationship with him? Or what are some good ways? I think you've got a catalog on your website on MeatRx. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a lot of stuff in this area here. So I think one of the things is, why are we seeing this push to go plant-based? Is it truly to save the planet? What it really is they're creating a $150 billion a year industry that they're trying to get people to buy into. And so they're using this sustainability, this, this ethical
marketing.
It's marketing. It really is. And so whenever I see made with plants or plant-based, what that says to me is we're using cheap products at a high markup so we can make more money on you. And it's not going to improve you. By the way, it's not going to improve your health, but it's really about money. It's really about just creating this market, and people are buying them. It's a very good marketing strategy. In the end of the day, it's not doing what they're claiming it's doing. In fact, it's probably doing the opposite, quite honestly. But as far as how to get it. Now, I do think that the way we raise animals is important. And I do think that it does have an impact. I mean, hey, look, there's no industry on the world that doesn't have an environmental impact. And we have to eat. I mean, there's no negotiation about it. We can't, we're just going to give up eating. If we look at the United States, for instance, and I think this is where you and I live. In the United States, cows produce 2% of our greenhouse gases. 2%. I mean, that's not nothing, but it's not like the world's biggest, greatest thing in the world, right? So we're making all this big to-do about 2% while we're sitting there and we're saying, well, the oil and gas industry, the energy sector, the transportation sector, that accounts for about 80%, 80% versus 2%. So, I mean, Can I drive my bike to the store once a week rather than drive my car? That would have a bigger impact than taking out meat. In fact, if we were to, based on the actual numbers, these are EPA data numbers. You can look them up. They're very well published. If all Americans were to say go plant-based 100%, all 330 million of us just said, we're not going to eat meat anymore, right? We're going to save the planet. And this is the other part, and you took all 95 million cows and all 9 million dairy cows and all 10 million horses and all 140 million cats and dogs and 30 million sheep and all that stuff, and you wipe them off the face of the earth, the reduction in greenhouse gases in the United States would be about 2.5%. The worldwide impact of that huge, huge sacrifice would be about 0.4%. That's how much of a difference it would do to do that. That's nothing. It's like ridiculous. It's not even worth. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the end result of that is we would have people that were nutritionally deprived. They've done the calculations. They've run the model. You could actually produce about 25% more calories if you just had plant food. The problem is you would run into critical nutrient deficiencies. So it's just like everybody's eating sugar. We get more calories, but everybody's getting sicker and fatter because there's no nutrition. There's low quality protein. There's not enough zinc, there's not enough lysine, there's not enough leucine. So what you ended up doing, and then the other fact is, where are you going to get your fertilizer? 50% of all fertilizer in the world comes from animals. The rest is fossil fuels, the synthetic nitrogen phosphate, the NPK fertilizer, nitrogen phosphate, potassium, or potassium fertilizer. That's all being derived from fossil fuel derivatives. So you're turning this into the earth into a giant factory without anything that's restoring the soil and the land. And so animals, if managed properly, the problem is we've gone a little bit away from that, where we're managing them in a way that doesn't, provide the best impact to the environment. In the name of more efficiency, because back in the 1970s they said we need to cut the number of cows down, and we did. We used to have 130 million cattle back in the 1970s. We've cut that down to 90 million or 95 million. we're able to make just as much meat, in fact, more meat, but it comes at a price, you know, with that. And what the unintended consequence has been a destruction of soil health, a heavier reliance on herbicides and pesticides and all the negatives that go with that, and higher reliance on, you know, GMO crop foods and stuff like that. So we can get away from that. We certainly can. We can fix that. There's a lot of people that are showing that, that you can do it. And just as importantly and more importantly, they're able to do that at a profit, which is important for the rancher. These ranchers and farmers need to make money. They can't be starving. I mean, you can't expect them to feed you and go under and not make a profit. These people work hard. I mean, you think about it. How many days off does a cow take off? You know, they don't take
no.
days. They're there every day. It's like being a parent. It's like being a, you know, you can't just say, hey, well, we're going to go take a vacation in Hawaii while the kids take care of themselves. It doesn't happen. So they've got to be there 365 days a year. And a lot of them live in places where the weather ain't that good. So it's in the rain. It's in the snow. The cow gets sick. The cow gets hurt. They're taking it in their house. They're nursing it. They're up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning delivering cows. I mean, this is their life. And they do it because they love it. And they love these animals. And they take care of them. Yes, at the end of the day, they're going to slaughter those animals a couple years down the road. But during the time they have them, they really, really care about these things. And so I think that, you know, the sort of the push to push these people under the bus and not recognize the wonderful things they're doing for us to feed us, because, you know, thank God, because that gives us a chance to have these other careers, you know, have a family life. I mean, if you and I had to feed ourselves every day, you know, we're out in the backyard digging up, you know, tomato plants and chasing chickens around. And, you know, I mean, if we had to do that every day, we wouldn't have much time for anything else. We certainly wouldn't be, you know, doing our whatever job we have. So it's important that we continue to support these guys.
So buy from local farms would be your best solution, you would say.
That's a great solution. Yeah, if you can.
Yeah.
Like I said, okay. And you know, I mean, if you can't afford that, you know, here's what I would say. If you are on a tight budget and you can't afford to do it, maybe you don't have the freezer space. You know, a lot of these guys can't sell. Like even some of the laws in different states will prohibit you from buying like a steak from a, or ground beef from a farmer. That you've got to buy a half a beef or a quarter beef, and you may not have a, you know, a 20 cubic foot fridge to put it in or a freezer. And so you're like, I can't do that. Then I just say, go to the grocery store, buy what you can, buy it on sale. There's a nice, I use this website. It's called mygroceryDeals.com. If you don't know, I just look it up, mygroceryDeals.com. You type in your zip code, you type in steak or meat or beef or chicken or lamb, and it'll show you where the sales are. Go there, stock up. It's great. It's a great thing for those people who want to do that. Now, like I said, there's, you know, there's some issues in the meat industry between the big packing companies and the ranchers and all that stuff. And I don't necessarily want to get into that here, but at the end of the day, even the cheapest meat you can get from Walmart is going to be better for your health than the Doritos and the Twinkies and the Coca-Cola and the box food and the stuff that sits on the shelf for 10 years. And, you know, it's just not good for you. So that meat is a superfood, you know, no matter how you get it. If you can get it straight from the farmer, great for you if you got the relationship. And I encourage people to do that for sure. And, you know, the ranchers, I'm trying to encourage more and more ranchers to sell directly to consumers. A lot of them are seeing the writing on the wall and doing that. And that's one of the other things we do at the website. We promote ranchers and we try to facilitate those relationships. But
that's awesome.
That is something to do.
That's awesome. I appreciate it. Well, Sean, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but how can we stay connected with what you got going on? Is it just on the IG? Are you does your MeatRx have an Instagram? How can we stay connected?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we do have a social media MeatRx. I personally don't do much on that because it's okay. It's on autopilot for the most part. We've got some volunteers. You know, one thing, you know, it's kind of interesting, MeatRx, with so many volunteers, people are just, their lives have been changed. They're like, we just want to give back and help. And so we've got a huge team of volunteers that just kind of help make it happen. But I mean, at MeatRx, I'm there every single day, 7 days a week, 9 a.m. Pacific time. I spend an hour every day with the community. Whoever wants to be there, I'll answer your questions. I'll come in there and talk. That's part of the service of the thing. We have people sign up for a month for free. They can go in there. I am on Instagram. I put stuff up. I'm on Twitter. I just started. I'm almost sort of embarrassed to admit this, but I just started on TikTok. And so,
congratulations.
I'm kind of worried about that, but like I said, my Instagram, you know, it pisses some people off. I do goofy, funny stuff, which I think is just, you know, some people have a huge sense of humor. Some people don't. It's kind of funny. You see people that don't have a sense of humor, don't get it. But that really is just a vehicle to get people to listen, you know, because, you know, like I said, if all I did was sit there and read studies all day, no one would even listen.
No one cares.
No one cares. So the reason people even care is because I'm this big goofy guy that's an athlete. And sometimes I say kind of stuff that's at least controversial. And so people turn into it, and some people come in there and they say, I hate you, you're an idiot, blah, blah, blah. But it drives, you know, it drives the algorithm, drives the interaction. And right. You get people to tune in. And then you drop the message and you say, hey, look, this is how we're changing lives. And you, so, you know, like I said, it's just about exposure. This is how any marketing thing works. You know, you gotta get people to tune in before they'll listen. If they're flipping past the channel, you don't even have a chance. So that's
done.
Yeah, so I'm actually a fairly nice person.
I get the agree. I can agree with that. Was it at Sean Baker? What is it? 19? What is it? Oh,
my Instagram is at Sean Shawn Baker Baker 1967. That's Instagram. Twitter is at SBakerMD. And let's see, TikTok is Sean Baker MD. And then I've got a YouTube channel too. I usually put up like a 5-minute video every day, and it's not high production value. I don't have a big studio or anything like that. I just kind of look at my phone and say stuff for like 10 minutes, and you know, some people like it. Anyway,
I'll drop all of those links too in the show notes, man. But I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, it's been fun. Yeah. Anyway, like I said, there's a lot more to it. I mean, I can talk about this stuff for 10 hours, you know, in a row. I know I have sometimes, but you know, like I said, it's fine to have doubts. I would, you know, what I would do is, you know, like I said, if you want to find more, just go to MeterX, poke around the website, look at all the success stories, look at all the, we've compiled tons of research that's out there that you don't hear about. There's all these studies that show that meat isn't the bad guy. You know, I mean, if anything, you know, I would say, stop eating junk, just stop eating junk food. And the problem is that's hard to do. It's really, because it tastes so good. It's addictive. Right. And so how do you do that? You got to replace with something that's equally good. Most of us guys can appreciate a nice, you know, medium rare steak with a little bit of salt on there, or you know some, you know, good brisket or some ribs or eggs and bacon. I mean, that stuff tastes good to most people, particularly guys. I think it's a pretty easy sell for guys.
Easy.
And then you kind of go from there, and then you figure out the rest of the stuff. But that's kind of the easy way to start.
We'll start it from there, man. I think you've convinced me, and you probably convinced a lot of other young men too. So yeah. I appreciate it. I appreciate this. And man, I hope you have a good rest of your day.
All right. Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. Man. Thanks, Jim. Take care.
Bye. And there you have it, guys. Another one in the books. Guys, if you found this helpful at all, I encourage you to enjoy it, share it, and please leave us a rating and review on Apple iTunes. Guys, you didn't need any other reason to have an all meat diet, but I gave you a reason. I brought on an MD that said you could have an all meat diet. So please consider leaving me a rating and review just for that. If you hate all my other episodes, it's cool. Leave me a rating and review for giving you a chance to tell your wife, yo, we switching to all meat. Okay. That's all I'm asking. And if you're on IG, I encourage you to follow us on Instagram at Being Husband Pod. That's at Being Husband POD on Instagram. Give us a follow there. I'm regularly on there. Very active, very involved. And I want to continue to minister to you guys there in the best way that I can. So hope you all found this helpful. And I encourage you guys to have a great rest of your week. Take care and build on.